funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Spartacus change ancient Rome and the history of the world? And why do we remember his valor and leadership even though his quest for freedom ended in defeat and violent death? By courage, cunning, and indomitable will, this first century BC gladiator managed to transform an escaped attempt by a few dozen Roman slaves into an all-out rebellion that at its apex grew to a force of 60,000 men, women, and even children. Barry Strauss tells the story in a fascinating new book called The Spartacus War. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University, and we are delighted to have him with us to talk about his research. Barry, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with a little background about Spartacus himself. He was from what today is Bulgaria?
That's right. It was called Thrace in the ancient world.
And you describe the Thracians as an exceptionally belligerent people. Will you talk about their culture a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to the Thracians, our approach to them is mostly through the stereotypes of the Greeks and Romans. The Thracians were on the fringe of Greek and Roman civilization. And from the Greek and Roman point of view, the Thracians stood out as great fighters. They were among the best guerrilla fighters of the ancient world. They also were terrific horsemen. And they loved war. Thracian men looked down on other ways of living as inferior to fighting. And Thracian women also played a role in war, at least a very important support role, if not an actual fighting one.
Who were their most important gods?
Well, one of the most important gods was the god we call Dionysus. He was the national god of Thrace, as well as a Greek and Roman god also, but he played a more prominent role for the Thracians than for other peoples.
So what sort of contact did the Thracians and the Romans have, and what did they tend to fight over?
Well, Thrace was in the way, as it were, for Roman expansion. The Romans had expanded into Greece and also into what is today Turkey, Thrace was on the border of northern Greece, and the Romans and the Thracians tended to conflict, although there were some Thracian peoples who made alliances with the Romans.
And so Spartacus was a Thracian soldier originally.
He was. He was, unlike the movie, a famous 1960 movie, which portrays him as a slave and a son and grandson of slaves, he was actually a free man and a soldier. And he actually fought for the Romans rather than against them. That's how he starts out.
Do you just hate that movie?
No, I love the movie. Absolutely love the movie.
So,
you know, it's got a lot of inaccuracies. It's kind of got brilliant inaccuracies.
Yeah, so he starts out as a soldier, and how does he end up captured by the Romans?
Well, he's a soldier in the Roman army. He's fighting for the Romans, and he's in an allied unit, which is typical of this period, probably serving as a cavalryman, because that's what the Romans needed, and that's what they prized in the Thracians. And something goes wrong. We don't know exactly what. We get two different stories in the sources. One says that he deserts, and he becomes a combination bandit and insurgent. And some historians think that he ends up being disgusted by the mistreatment of the Thracians by the Romans, and so he joins the other side and then gets captured by the Romans. But I actually don't believe that. I think the evidence points in another direction. The evidence suggests that much simpler story. He gets captured. He's fighting with the Romans. There's a battle. He gets captured, and he's sold to a slave dealer who ends up selling him to the Romans, and they make him a gladiator. And as you can imagine, Spartacus protests. He says, wait a minute. I'm one of you guys. I'm your ally. You can't enslave me. It's utterly unjust, and even Roman sources talk about the injustice of it.
And what they didn't realize, of course, was that during this time he had been fighting with the Romans, he learned a lot about their MO on the battlefield.
He did. He clearly was a brilliant soldier and a very, very intelligent man. And he was, as it were, taking notes as all this happened.
So let's talk about the sorts of people who tended to be pressed into service, if that's the right word, as gladiators. These were sort of known to be, in some ways, the most dangerous of men.
Yes, they're very dangerous men. They are, with a few exceptions, criminals, and they have committed very serious crimes. And this is considered one of the worst punishments you can give someone, to make him a gladiator.
Can you talk about what was expected of gladiators?
Well, gladiators were trained to fight, and the training they received was, in many ways, quite similar to the training that recruits into the Roman legions would receive. That is, they were trained above all to fight with swords. They're very good swordsmen. But they learned some tricks of the trade, some of the tricks of the gladiatorial trade as well. For instance, they learned where to aim to make somebody bleed a lot but not do a lot of serious damage. And they learned how to please the crowd. The other thing they learned, which is really important for gladiators, was they learned how to die well. Major part of the gladiatorial art was not to flinch, but to realize when your time was up, to accept the sword, and to put on a good show.
The Romans were smart enough to realize that in these places where they were training hordes of gladiators, they might, in fact, form alliances based on their national origins. And
yes.
So they tried to keep them very ethnically mixed.
They did. They tried to keep them ethnically mixed. Mm-hmm. And in the place where Spartacus served as a gladiator, we know that there were at least three ethnic groups: his own, Thracians; second, Germans; and third, Celts. And Celts in this period could include both men from Gaul, what is today France or Belgium, and also men from the Balkans, because in this period of history, the Balkans had extensive Celtic settlement.
So they were competing with swords when they were performing as gladiators, but they didn't have access to weapons clearly on a regular basis.
No, the weapons were locked up. They would be given the weapons to train under supervision by guards, and then the weapons were kept locked up.
So, and this is such an interesting part of the book, they go into the kitchen when
yes.
they decide to escape. And first of all, you describe this as a really horrific place back in those times.
Yeah, I mean, this is not going to be a kitchen out of House Beautiful. This is going to be a dirty, unpleasant room, odorous, it did double duty. It had other functions in the house besides the kitchen. I'll let your imagination wander. But they go in there and they take the only weapons they have, which are kitchen knives, cleavers, if you will, and skewers. And they use them to butcher and fight their way out of the gladiatorial barracks.
And it makes sense that they knew how to apply a skewer to the same places that they might apply a sword.
Yes. We should also keep in mind that these are going to be really big guys and strong guys. Gladiators were very well fed. They also had doctors who looked after them. Ironically, they are going to be some of the healthiest people in the Roman world.
Yeah, talk for a minute, if you would, Barry, about the difference in status between a gladiator and a common slave who might have to do some other kind of job.
Well, the irony of it is that in many ways, gladiators were privileged slaves. They as I said, they were very well fed, and they had medical attention, and they were educated. They learned a trade, and if they were successful, they were treated as celebrities. They were great public figures. They were able to win prizes and monetary rewards as well as adulation. They were sex symbols, and know that they got sex as well for their performance. And if they lived long enough, they could actually win their own freedom. The catch is that very few live long enough, and the average gladiator would have a very short life expectancy indeed.
Did every gladiatorial contest end in the death of one of the competitors?
No. No, that would have been too expensive to actually do that, because it's quite expensive to train these people. I think the majority of them would not end with the death of one of the competitors.
They were known, even before this rebellion, to be dangerous enough that the good and sort of upstanding people of Rome didn't want them right there in the city. They trained sort of far outside the city.
That's right. The center of gladiatorial training is a city called Capua, which is near Naples, and it's about 125 miles outside of Rome. It was considered too dangerous to have them in Rome itself.
So do we know anything about what caused Spartacus to decide on the day that this all happened that he was going to try and get out?
No, we don't. And the movie makes it seem as if the owners pushed him too far and finally he exploded. In the film, if you remember, he falls in love with another slave, and the owner decides to sell this slave to a Roman, and she's going to go off to Rome. And that's what pushes Spartacus to rebel. Now, that's an interesting and clever twist on one fact that we do know. And the fact that we do know is that Spartacus really was in love with another slave. In fact, he was either married to her or lived in a common law relationship with her. We don't know her name, unfortunately, but we do know that, like him, she was a Thracian. She came, in fact, from the same tribe of Thracians.
And in addition to being his lover, she had a great influence on the things that he thought about.
Yes. She was a prophetess. She worshipped the god Dionysus, and she went into trances. She went into ecstatic trances in which she would have visions. And in the visions, she prophesied that Spartacus was going to have a great and fearsome power. And this very significant because, as I mentioned earlier, Dionysus is a Thracian god, but he's also a god for Greeks and Romans, and he's the god of wine, as we know him, but he's also the god of liberation. He's the god that slaves look to as hope for hopes of getting rid of their chains and becoming free.
Now, Dionysus was not a god for Germans or Celts.
That's a really interesting question. In theory, he wasn't, but it's hard to believe that when their contact in the Roman world that they didn't also come into contact with Dionysus. Just how much he meant to them is not so clear. I'm not sure that Dionysus would have been a great calling card for Spartacus to play with the Celts and the Germans, but it would have helped them, of course, with other Thracians and also with the Greek slaves of southern Italy.
So when they first got out, they went to Mount Vesuvius. Why specifically was that a good place to go if you were escaping?
Vesuvius was an excellent place to go. For one thing, it wasn't too far. It was 20 miles away. For another thing, it's not the Vesuvius that we think of with the eruption of 79 AD and the destruction of Pompeii. It's a dormant volcano in this period of history, and it's got volcanic soil, hence it's immensely fertile. And it's ringed by farms. These are among the wealthiest farms, most well-stocked farms in the Roman world, a terrific place to raid. And Thracians are very good at mountains. Thracians really did mountains. And they would have made excellent leaders to go down Vesuvius to raid these farms and then to go back up the mountain and use the top of the mountain as a refuge.
So they started with 70-something people. How did this start to grow so quickly?
Well, we have to use our imagination because we don't know precisely. But I would imagine that they were not inconspicuous, these 70-something slaves, as they made their way to Vesuvius. And as they start raiding these estates, the word gets out as to what's going on. Just imagine yourself a slave working in the fields, and these rebels come in. They kill the master or frighten him off. And they start helping themselves to the loot and to the agricultural wealth, and they say, join us. And I think there were quite a few slaves who would have said, you bet.
Yeah, and I guess at this point it should come as no surprise to people. This was not a band of Boy Scouts trying to secure the freedom of all oppressed people.
No, they weren't. And that I'm afraid the movie tends to paint them in those rosy colors. Many of them were bent on revenge, and they didn't make a whole lot of distinctions among civilians. They killed masters, but they also killed the innocent. They raped women. They were on a rampage of destruction.
But initially on this rampage, the Romans didn't take a whole lot of notice when it was sort of a local problem.
Well, the Romans took some notice. They didn't pull all the stops out in putting it down. They sent a small force of several thousand men from Rome to Vesuvius to put down the gladiators. Roman armies, of course, were much bigger, and they could have sent far more men to it. But they're not taking it as seriously as they might, at least in the beginning.
Barry Strauss is my guest. He's a professor of history and classics at Cornell University. His new book is called The Spartacus War. We'll be back to talk more about it, and we'll take your questions now when you call 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email to thinkkera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Barry Strauss. He is professor of history and classics at Cornell University. His new book is called The Spartacus War. You're welcome to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending an email to think@kera.org. Just so we get some perspective on the amount of sympathy that there might have been to this rebellion, what was the slave to free population in the Roman Empire at this time?
Well, in Italy, slaves were about 20% of the population.
This is
an estimate, of course, because our figures are far from perfect.
And therefore, some of them were they sort of universally treated horribly, or were there some slaves that fared well?
No, slaves in the cities, in general, did much better than slaves in the countryside. Slaves in the city had a softer and easier existence, and they had a possibility of earning some money and, in fact, earning their freedom, because the Romans were far more willing to entertain freeing slaves than were in later slave systems in American slavery, for instance. If you were a slave in the countryside, on the other hand, you would have a much more difficult existence.
It was mostly farm labor and things like that?
Yeah, the two main activities were farm labor and herding various animals. And the worst, I think, was being on a farm, because there you really would have to work in chains and live under very primitive existence and have very, very menial, very difficult labor with very low level of material existence.
We have an email here from Mark in Garland who wants to know whether there were female gladiators.
There were female gladiators. We know of a few female gladiators in a somewhat later period than this, but there were some.
And would they compete against men?
Excellent question. Not that I know of. As far as I know, they competed against other women.
What kinds of records do you comb through to find new evidence or to sort of reinterpret what we think we've already known? Where do you go for this?
Well, it's both very difficult and very easy. I had to do a couple of things. One, our basic sources are so-called literary evidence. These are things written by elite writers in the ancient world about Spartacus, and there are a few writers who were alive at the time and who wrote about Spartacus, and then a larger group of writers who lived later, 50 years later, hundreds of years later, and who wrote something about Spartacus. And so the first thing you have to do is read everything that they wrote. Which is not all that difficult, because unfortunately, not much of their work survives. In some cases, we're talking about a phrase here, a sentence there. The second thing you have to do is to gather and analyze the archaeological evidence. There's not a huge amount of it, but there is a certain amount, and that has to be combed through as well. And then the third thing, the really hard part, is you have to go to Italy, and you have to try to walk where Spartacus walked and try to reconstruct what the countryside was like and what the experience of constantly moving through the Italian countryside might have been like in this period of history.
You also, I guess, have the challenge, in addition to the burden of having to travel to Italy, of working with source material that was written solely by the victors.
Absolutely right. Yes, we don't have a single word that was written by the Thracians, by the Celts or the Germans, or by any of the slaves. We only have things from the victor's point of view. And yet that also gets to one of the most intriguing parts of the story, is that quite a lot of the Roman sources are pro-Spartacus. Many of them admired him, and that's really quite striking.
So he was sort of admired. Was he also feared? Were there people who were sort of contacting their government officials and saying, we want protection from this marauding
band? Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the overwhelming response was fear, terror, anger. Because the slave revolt the slaves were plundering the Italian countryside. They were ruining people's livelihood. They were taking away their wealth and prosperity, as well as, in some cases, threatening their lives. So there was deep pressure being put on the Roman government to do something about this.
So let's talk for a minute about Spartacus and his leadership, because as we mentioned, he had Thracians in his band, but there were also Celts and Germans.
Right.
And he didn't sort of try to boss everyone directly.
Well, I think he did try. He just didn't succeed. He was not able to impose his will on this army or at least he was only able to impose his will on this army for brief periods. Again and again, he was faced with the problem of splinter groups, and in at least two periods in the revolt, the army actually split into two. At one point, relatively early on, a group under a Celtic general simply left. They went off on their own. And then later on, near the end of the revolt, another group under Celtic and German generals also left and went on their own.
And we should say that not all of these guys, Spartacus wanted to sort of get back home,
right,
if possible, but not everybody felt that way. Some of them had been born into slavery within the empire.
Right. Yeah, this is a major, there's a major difference of opinion as to what's the strategy and indeed the purpose of the revolt. From Spartacus's point of view, the point of the revolt is to gather an army and then leave. He, by this point, he's an enemy of Rome, but he's a realist, and he realizes that if they stay in Italy, ultimately the Romans will pull their troops back from abroad, where their main armies are, and suppress the rebellion. The Romans are not going to allow this to continue. So he wants to leave, men should disperse to their various countries. Perhaps he'll lead an anti-Roman group in the free part of Thrace. But the majority of his troops disagree. Many of them, as you say, were born in Italy and knew no other homeland. Others might have known another homeland, but they thought, what's the reason to leave? We're doing so well here. They thought Spartacus was being overly pessimistic.
So how did the Romans ultimately select Pompey and Cassius to take specific leadership roles in trying to put down the rebellion?
Well, the Romans, and in particular the Roman Senate, is trying hard to avoid giving a special command to anyone, because they realize that any ambitious politician would use this as a way of building up his own authority as opposed to that of the Senate. But ultimately, Spartacus does so well and inflicts so many defeats on the Romans that they are forced to give this special command to Crassus, who is the wealthiest man in Rome, very ambitious politician, experienced general, wanted his own power base, and succeeds in building an army. The army doesn't defeat Spartacus fast enough for many people's taste, and so Pompey, who's Rome's greatest general in this period, Pompey had been in Spain putting down a revolt there, but by the second year of the Spartacus revolt, the revolt in Spain is over, and so they recall him to come back to Italy and help Crassus out.
Let's talk, how were they armed? Because obviously the Roman soldiers would have had what they were provided. Were the people fighting with Spartacus just using whatever they were able to plunder when they would overtake a farm or something?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. They certainly plunder arms from the Roman soldiers who they kill or capture, and then they use them. They also melt down their chains and turn those into weapons. Spartacus issues an edict saying that they're not allowed to keep any gold or silver, but they must sell it and convert everything into iron and bronze, which can also be used to making weapons of war. And they make makeshift weapons. For instance, one thing they do early on is they take sticks and they harden the tip of them in the embers of a fire. They don't have a spear, but they have this hardened end of a stick that they can use as a spear.
Were they also motivated, Barry, by the fact that they could get treasure from these places that they invaded?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. They're in it for the loot, and that's a major draw for them. Italy is the wealthiest place in the Mediterranean in this period. The Romans have themselves been looting the Mediterranean for centuries and drawing all this wealth into Italy. And this is a chance for the slaves to get back.
So this is going on for months and 2 years. When did things start to turn the other direction so that the Romans began to have control over this fight?
Well, in the second year, in the autumn of the second year of the revolt, the revolt begins either in spring or early summer. It's when Crassus is appointed commander. Crassus does several things. First of all, he raises a huge army, much bigger than the Romans have been having before. Raises an army of 45,000 men, which is about the size of the army that Caesar would later use to conquer Gaul. And it's bigger than the army that Hannibal had when he invaded Italy. Second, Crassus manages to convince some veteran soldiers to come out of retirement and to come back and help him with this army and build a cadre of experienced fighters. And third, Crassus imposes very brutal discipline on the army. He brings back an old Roman punishment called decimation, which when something goes wrong, you kill every 10th man at random. It's quite frightening. And it makes the point to the soldiers that they ought to be more afraid of Crassus than they are of Spartacus.
And that seems to have worked. There was a point at which he gave up how many of his own men when he decimated? If he started with, was it 40,000 troops or something?
Well, he doesn't decimate all of them. Probably he only kills 50. One source says that only 50 of his men are killed, and another one says that 500 of his men are killed. In general, in ancient history, it's best to err on the side of being conservative. So let's say he kills 50 of his men. That's enough to make a point.
Yeah. Was there sort of media at this time beyond the things that were written as sort of accounts of what happened much later on? Was there the equivalent of a newspaper of any kind? Hmm.
There wasn't a newspaper, but there were criers who would give the news. And certainly there were gossip networks, and news would be read from place to place. And I think that we can imagine politicians like Crassus and Pompey and even Spartacus himself engaging in spin.
Huh. How far beyond Rome did the story spread?
Well, that's an excellent question. We know that about a decade later, after it's all over, there is a king in what is today Turkey who is a longtime rebel against Rome, a real troublemaker from the Romans' point of view. And he tells the story of Spartacus, and he uses it to try to encourage some Celtic soldiers to invade Italy, saying, Spartacus got so much support in Italy. If you invade Italy, you'll find people will rise up to accept you if you follow what Spartacus did. They weren't convinced, and they did not invade Italy.
So Spartacus was able to nearly escape, including at the very end of his life, but then he chose, such a dramatic story. He had a horse, but he chose not to use it.
Yes. Ultimately, it comes down to a conventional battle between Spartacus and his army on the one hand and Crassus and the Roman legions on the other. And rather than escaping into the hills as he might have, Spartacus actually sacrifices his horse in front of his whole men. Now, he's not the first general in antiquity to kill his horse as a sign of his seriousness of purpose, but it has a special poignance for him because the horse is a great religious symbol for the Thracians. And he's engaging in a ritual sacrifice in order to make the point to the Thracians in the army and perhaps to others who are now familiar with Thracian customs of just how serious and solemn a moment this is.
Would a general like Crassus have been right there in the fray, or would he have been sort of back behind the lines commanding things from a distance?
He would have been very close to the front.
Hmm. And so it was Crassus and his men that defeated Spartacus?
Yes. Yes, and in this last battle, Spartacus, knowing he was outnumbered and probably outclassed, tried a desperate strategy of decapitating the Roman army. He tried to actually kill Crassus, hoping that that would cause the Romans to despair and fall apart.
But obviously Crassus survived the battle.
Crassus survived. Spartacus came close. He kills some officers on the way to Crassus, but ultimately the Romans prove too much for him. They wound him and force him down and kill him.
What do the people in the surrounding areas do when one of these gigantic battles comes to their neighborhood?
Run. It must have been awfully scary to have a battle, as you say, coming to your neighborhood.
Yeah, so people would really just hear about it and sort of head for the hills.
I think so. You didn't want to be anywhere near the battlefield.
So Crassus defeats Spartacus and takes him down. How many of the sort of remaining people who'd been fighting with Spartacus at this time survived initially?
Probably a very large number survive. At this point, you know, the army has split in two, and the other half has already been defeated. And as a guesstimate, I would say that Spartacus had 30, 35,000 troops, as well as an unknown number of women and children who were with him as well. And I think a very significant number of them survive. Everyone who can runs into the hills to escape from the Romans.
It's hard. Go ahead.
Take place near some pretty big hills. But the Romans chase them. Mm-hmm. They follow them.
And Crassus decides to send a very loud and clear message to any other Roman slaves who might have designs on rebellion.
He does. He engages in what we might call today an information operation. He has 6,000 of these captured slaves, and he crucifies them all along the road between Capua and Rome.
So it's sort of simultaneously, you can walk along this road and see
yeah.
all these crucifixes.
That's right. That's
huh.
right. It would have been a gruesome and unforgettable sight.
It's almost hard to imagine what it would take to subdue these captives to the extent that you could get them up in such large numbers.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, obviously they must have had swords to their throats or anything something, but it just seems like a huge problem to keep them from rebelling again once they were about to be crucified.
Yes, it's true. It would have been a major operation, and it also would have been very expensive, because think of all the wood they needed and all the nails and all the rope they needed. My guess is that Crassus paid for this himself, and it is just a guess. But I think the mere logistics of it would have impressed people. To carry something like this off is no small thing, as you very astutely point out.
And in Roman culture, this was so interesting to me, there was a magical significance almost given to pieces of crucifixes that had been used to execute someone.
Yes, in Roman culture and in other cultures in the ancient world, it was thought that nails and wood from crucifixes used to execute people would have a magical purpose. You could use them as amulets against certain diseases afterwards.
So a lot of people remember that in the movie, Spartacus was crucified.
Right.
You don't believe that's what happened?
No. The sources are very clear that he wasn't crucified, that he dies on the battlefield, and that his body was never found.
Since his body was never found, what can we know other than the fact that he died on the battlefield? We don't really know who sort of stabbed him or whatever way he died.
No, we don't. We do know that... Are you asking how he's remembered?
Yeah.
Well, we do know that the Roman elite writers, so these would be masters, not slaves, remember Spartacus very well, because Spartacus crops up in Latin literature and Greek literature for centuries after this. The more intriguing question is, how do ordinary people in Italy remember him, and how do slaves remember him?
We will talk about that after this break. My guest is Barry Strauss. His new book is called The Spartacus War. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of History and Classics at Cornell University, Barry Strauss. His new book is called The Spartacus War. You're welcome to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We'll talk about legacy in a minute, Barry, but I do want to talk about what was the immediate effect of the Spartacus War after the defeat of Spartacus on public opinion and on priorities within the Roman Empire.
Well, the immediate effect was to beef up security with anything having to do with gladiators. The Romans were more worried than ever about the threat of gladiators, and many politicians actually hired gladiators on their staff as bodyguards, as you will, or more bluntly, muscle. And the authorities were very careful that at times of disorder that gladiators should be dispersed, that they should not be allowed to stay together in a big barracks, but rather be sent to different places where they could be guarded.
Was the victory that Crassus had over Spartacus a sort of score for the Romans in terms of getting people to submit to their will and agree that their protection was critical?
I would say it was more a score for keeping the slaves in line in Italy, more a score for maintaining things on the home front. But Rome still faced some very serious opposition abroad, and it required a lot more than this victory over Spartacus to deal with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Toby in Dallas. Hi, Toby.
Hi. I just had a question. Sir, what do you think would have happened if Spartacus actually would have succeeded in what he had done. I mean, as far as the future of Italy. And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Of what would have happened to Italy if Spartacus had succeeded?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Spartacus had succeeded, he would have, remember, he would have left Italy. He would have gone back to Thrace, and there would have been other slaves who had gone to Celtic lands or to German lands. And I think what they would have done would have been to have ignited local rebellions and have added fuel to the flames of local resistance to Rome. I don't know that they would have been able to bring down the Roman Empire, but I think they would have caused a lot of trouble for Romans locally, and they would have perhaps have been able to guarantee or to bring freedom to people as opposed to the Romans and allow them to live in freedom longer.
How dependent was the prosperity of the Roman Empire on slave labor?
Oh, it was very dependent on slave labor, particularly in this period. As the Romans had been expanding for several centuries before this, and particularly in the 100 years or so before Spartacus, their expansion also consisted of just a gigantic looting of the Mediterranean and stealing people and forcing people into slavery. For a long period, they winked and nodded at the presence of pirates who were essentially kidnappers and were selling people into slavery. Just a huge forced migration of people from other countries, particularly in the East, though not only in the East, from these other countries into Italy to serve as the Roman slaves.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Mark in Dallas. Hello, Mark.
Yes. I have a question for the guest. There's a story that the crucifixions by Crassus were retaliation for the Spartacus' crucifixion of Roman armies down in the toe of Italy when he was trapped down there. What does the guest think about that?
It's a good point. What Spartacus did was when he was trapped in the toe of the Italian boot, he crucified one Roman prisoner of war in the between the lines, between the Roman lines and his own lines. And the sources say, oddly enough, that those aimed so not so much at the Romans as at his own men, to remind them what they were fighting for and to remind them that if they lost the war, they would have been crucified by the Romans. So I don't think Crassus was retaliating against Spartacus for this one crucifixion so much as he was doing on a vast scale what was the normal punishment for runaway slaves. Crucifixion was, in fact, the normal punishment for runaway slaves.
How did the sort of image of Spartacus expand after his death? Was he in fact mythologized?
Well, you know, the yes and no. We know that he was mythologized by the ruling class because he crops up in poetry and in history and, most shockingly, in theology. St. Augustine, writing The City of God hundreds of years after Spartacus, is still writing about Spartacus and his importance for the Romans. So we know that he was never forgotten. And there are other writers at the end of the Roman Empire who are still writing about Spartacus. More interesting question is, what about ordinary people, and how did they remember Spartacus? And by and large, we're reduced to guessing. The only piece of evidence that we have that's a little better than a guess, although it's still not dispositive, is a fresco that comes from Pompeii, discovered in the 1920s, that dates back to sometime in the 1st century BC, and it's a scene of two gladiatorial combats, almost like a cartoon, and each of the combatants, there are four combatants, each of them has his name written above his head, but only one of them has a name that can still be read, and that name, amazingly enough, is Spartacus. Is this some kind of commentary on the Spartacus revolt? Also an interesting thing is that it's not written in Latin or in Thracian. It's written in a language called Oscan, which was the native language of Pompeii, and which was a language of protest and resistance to Rome in this period. For complicated reasons, we really can't be sure that this refers to Spartacus or that the dating is even right. But there's a chance that it does, and I think it's an intriguing piece of evidence.
So what's your best guess about what regular people thought?
My best guess is that regular people remembered Spartacus, and they thought of him as a symbol of resistance and uprising to the Romans. Another thing that I can point out is that the rebellion doesn't end when Spartacus is killed in 71 BC, and even when the slaves are crucified slightly afterwards. But it goes on for 10 years. For 10 more years, there are survivors in the mountains of southern Italy who are continuing to the rebellion on a very small, very local scale. And it's only 10 years later that the Romans bother to put them down. So my guess, and it is really a guess, is that there is a tradition of resistance centered on Spartacus that does survive.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Barry Strauss. The book is called The Spartacus War. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Dominic. Hey, Dominic.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question for the gentleman. Is it true that Crassus met his end somewhere around Persia or Iraq on a campaign trying to make a bigger name for himself and looking for riches? I think I read somewhere one time where he actually lost the battle. He let his cavalry get too far ahead of the infantry, and the horse archers took out his cavalry and then slowly picked off the infantry, and eventually they cut off his head or something and poured gold down his throat because he was looking for gold.
Do you know the story, Barry?
Yeah, that's almost entirely accurate.
Wow.
It is true that he's killed in battle, after a battle in the east, in what is nowadays the Syrian-Iraqi border, and he's fighting the Persian Empire, and it's absolutely true that he loses the battle because of his cavalry, and it's also true that after he dies, he is decapitated. Gold is not poured down his throat, though. That's another Roman fighting, another Roman general fighting in Turkey, rather, so slightly earlier. One story is that Crassus' head is used as a prop in a Greek tragedy in the court of the king who had defeated them. So
yeah,
it's a terrible end for him in either case.
I was going to say, we think we're bad now, but...
Yeah, they were pretty bad.
Exceptionally creative and sadistic ways to treat their enemies.
Absolutely.
We have an email from Ryan who asks about the kinds of games that Spartacus would have played in order to train him to be such a fierce warrior.
You mean as a gladiator?
Yeah.
Well, the training would start out with wooden swords, and you would use these wooden swords against poles. You'd have to be able to show that you could slash and hack appropriately against a pole, and then you would work out with wooden swords and wooden shields against each other, and only then would you graduate to to metal swords and regular shields.
So how were gladiators identified from sort of the common pool of slaves, and did they have to audition for this?
Well, gladiators generally didn't have any choice about the matter. When they were sold as slaves, they would be bought. They went to a slave market, they'd be sold, and they would be bought by an entrepreneur. There were people who ran gladiatorial establishments or who were investors in gladiatorial establishments. Julius Caesar, slightly later on, would own 1,000 slaves. Now, he didn't actually run the business. He hired people who ran the business, but they would buy slaves for him who would serve as gladiators. I should also point out that a small number of gladiators were not slaves at all. They were free men and even Roman citizens. Why did they become gladiators? They wanted the thrill of this. They to them, this was a kind of very dangerous slumming.
Let's go next to Kevin in Dallas. Hello, Kevin.
Yes. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you. I love your program very much, and I have a question. My question is this. What's the contribution of Persians to Spartacus' rebellion and his siege?
Question is, was there a contribution of Persians?
Persians.
Well, we don't know of any Persians who had been enslaved and who had been gladiators in Italy in this period. So we can't say that there was any direct contribution. It's possible that there were Persian gladiators. On the other hand, there was this revolt going on in the east, centered in what is today Turkey, and the leader of that revolt, a king by the name of Mithridates, was of partial Persian descent, and he was causing the Romans one of the biggest headaches they'd had for a very long time. So we could say that indirectly there's a Persian contribution.
Are there physical descriptions in the record of Spartacus?
There are, but they're very, very limited. One, our best description tells us that he was a man of great strength and great intelligence. And another one tells us that as a gladiator, he was a mermelot. And a mermelot is the quintessential heavyweight gladiator. And that tells us that he is a very big, strong man, because only the biggest and the strongest would serve as a mermelot.
On the other hand, you write that Spartacus's defeat was both a failure of the intellect and of the imagination. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, I think that it's certainly a failure on the part of his allies and his army to realize that they needed to get out of Italy and that they were playing with fire by staying in Italy. When we're talking about Spartacus, let me preface my next remarks by saying that we have to engage in speculation. The sources just don't allow us to do anything else. And we notice, this is not speculation, that Spartacus was not able to impose his will on the army. And I have to ask myself, was this a failure on his part? Was it a failure to be ruthless enough to get rid of his opponents, doing whatever was necessary so that he would be the supreme honcho in this army and that he could say to his men, this is it, like it or not, we're crossing the Alps, we're leaving in Italy. In a sense, we might say that Spartacus was almost too good. He was too willing to compromise and too willing to accept the need to make deals with others.
So why do you think, Barry, that outside of your profession, Spartacus is a household word and Crassus is not?
Isn't that a wonderful irony?
Mm-hmm.
Because we all love underdogs. And Crassus is a very unappealing person. He's Mr. Moneybags, and he gets his money in a kind of a grim way by being parasitical on people whose houses are on fire. He has the only fire brigade in Rome, or one of the only fire brigades in Rome.
So that's not a metaphor. This is a true story.
This is a true story. And, you know, your house is on fire, and Crassus will come and say, you know, do you want it to be worth anything? Sell it to me for real cheap, and I'll put the fire out. One of the ways that he got his money. He's also a cruel man in many and various ways. But Spartacus is this hero of a revolt. And as I said, several of the Roman sources emphasize his nobility, his intelligence, his lofty ideals, his humanism. He tried to prevent his men from engaging in atrocities against innocent civilians. His patriotism. He wanted to go home to his land, his homeland of Thrace. And no matter how you slice it, he wanted to free slaves. So there's something very noble about Spartacus and appealing also to the Romans.
Barry Strauss is professor of history and classics at Cornell University. His new book is called The Spartacus War. Barry, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.